Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. We are coming to you live from frozen tundra of Virginia. We're happy that you're back. And before we get started, I have something to clear up from our last episode, which
Well, maybe you should introduce yourself first. Oh, Who are you?
I'm the Patriarch.
And I'm the Progeny, and we're also joined by the Professor today. Okay.
And
we've got some clarifications from last week.
Yes, one of which is I used the phrase, I hate when someone says this, that I use the phrase, I could care less.
I'm so glad you caught that. It nearly made me weep.
Yep.
I was just over here having melting. I'm just like, you didn't.
And I did. So
I thought about editing in part of your voice from another part, just to
really
and somehow fleshing it out so you said I couldn't care less.
Yeah.
But
so
okay,
I guess I was caught up in the moment.
You have repented. You are forgiven, my son.
Thank you. So I have my milk duds. And we've survived the first big snowfall of the year, even though it's middle of February.
How many inches did we get?
Probably about 6 or 8.
Meanwhile, all of our New England listeners are having a good laugh at our expense.
Yeah, but our New England listener. But hopefully over the next 48 hours, we've got some very cold temperatures coming, and if we survive that, maybe we'll make it till April. So, what are we talking about tonight?
We're going to be talking about Westerns, and specifically, some of the Westerns we've seen recently. We just finished up watching The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and A Fistful of Dollars, starring Clint Eastwood from the 60s, which I didn't expect to enjoy, because I remembered The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as being just kind of this bizarre, wacky, stylized movie that spent a lot of time waiting while people were about to draw guns, and I thought that sounds really boring. But in fact, it's quite a ride. I really enjoyed it.
It would be The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is just about as good as you can get on that. It's just a terrific movie. It would be phenomenal on the big screen. You know, I think it would be a completely different movie on the big screen with good music and stuff, or good. Good sound, which we don't have here in the patriarchal theatrical HQ is pretty poor when it comes to that kind of stuff.
We are taking donations, though,
so you
could help us out.
Yeah, we already have a hand-me-down flat-screen TV, All of our TVs are hand-me-down.
Okay, I don't think we have any comments this week, so I guess we can go ahead and jump right in. Well, the first thing I want to talk about, just kind of some of the history of the Westerns, kind of how they were made, where they were made. Do you want to cover that, or shall I?
I don't know anything about that.
Well, I mean, you know quite a bit about the spaghetti Westerns.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know much about them. You better cover that.
Okay. Sergio Leone, that how you pronounce his name?
I don't know.
You really aren't much help today.
I don't know how to pronounce Clint Eastwood.
That's nice. Okay. Well,
I heard a song on the way home, like him on the local station. He was singing with Merle Haggard, Barroom Buddy. You need to look it up.
Yeah, I think I might need to.
Yeah.
I feel a sudden desperate need to.
He wasn't singing per se. It was more Lou Reedish, which is what they would just like talk with music in the background.
I need to show you this video. Okay, well, You had all the great westerns of the 50s, and before that, when you had John Wayne and who was it? John Ford. I'm not tremendously familiar with them, but
yeah,
you had a long tradition of all those, and then in the 60s, along came Sergio Leone, who was an unknown Italian director who had moved all of his cast to Italy and filmed a bunch of Spanish extras pretending to be Civil War veterans and two or three American actors speaking English, but everybody else speaking Italian. Done all this, made just kind of this real low-budget movie, and then suddenly taken over the Western genre pretty much forever. It was a real Renaissance movie trilogy. The three movies were Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More, which I have not seen, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, all of which star Clint Eastwood as the man with no name. They have a number of things in which they are kind of different from the other movies. Among them is the terrain. I think the terrain really plays a strong part in the movie. It's something, it feels kind of much more rugged and unpredictable than, say, the kind of the deserts and plateaus of a John Wayne movie, or The Magnificent Seven or something like that. I don't remember much about the cinematography in any of those movies. I thought it was kind of blah. But these movies, they have a real sharp, dark clarity about this land, and it really feels like a character. And the heat, you can feel the heat, it's a very sensory movie. They're very sensory movies. Also, of course, you have some differences in music. This is a very distinctive type of music, especially the score for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But you can kind of see that drawing up coming in through the other movies. And the music was composed by Ennio Morricone, who's also known for, among other things, The Mission, and Leone's other movies, Once Upon a Time in America.
But he does it's a remarkable. The music is, I mean, if you take the music out of these movies, they become something else entirely. He really carries it along because there's long pauses and long shots.
Because they didn't have much money to film the entire thing, Clint Eastwood actually requested that they cut, it was a mixture of the fact that Clint Eastwood wanted to cut lines because he thought it made his character stronger to be silent, and the fact that they just didn't have the money to shoot a lot of dialogue, which meant that they ended up having lots of long pauses in which Ennio Morricone got to do his thing. And it's quite a thing. So it's a lot like what John Williams did for the Star Wars movies. I know we've already mentioned that video on YouTube where they removed the music and replace it with people coughing and people, you know, kind of looking at each other. The last scene in the first Star Wars movie. And it's remarkable how the whole scene just changes. You know, it's amazing. He really creates an oral backdrop. And Morricone does the same for these movies, creating this...
a palette of sound.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you. And he, there's so many close-ups, and everybody's so dirty, and everybody's sweating, and everybody's smoking, you know, cheroots that are down to their stub. And
yeah, you have some really amazing...
You really get into their skin rather than, you know, some guy getting shot up with his horse at 150 yards away by John Wayne. That's not the way they do it here. So it's really well done. I enjoy it.
You really have some amazing shots with the extras.
And they're funny, too.
Yeah, they're quite funny. It's often gallows humor.
Yeah.
It's quite dark, kind of black humor. You can kind of see it leading up to guys like the Coen brothers. Roger Ebert, in his review of the movie, was talking about the extras, and he said, these guys look like they're out of a Dickens movie instead of kind of the bland Hollywood extras. These guys, they've got some real texture there. You can tell that they're real people. And they often were real people that Leone would just drag in off the street and plop down in his movie.
There were a lot of people in that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it may have been a low-budget movie, but those guys must not have been paid much, because I mean, the Civil War shots where they at the bridge, there must have been, you know, like 1,000 guys out there.
I don't think there were 1,000. else.
I bet there were. I bet it was close. Hmm. It certainly seemed that way. When, especially down at the bridge, when they're all fighting on the bridge. I don't know. Maybe several hundred, but it's a lot of guys.
Okay, the final thing that I kind of wanted to focus on in the movie, which I think makes it kind of an iconic movie that it is the hero himself. He's quite different from previous heroes, and this is what attracted Clint Eastwood to the character, in that the first scene in A Fistful of Dollars, which is a remake of a Japanese movie, in that first scene, Clint Eastwood's character is watching as a little boy is kind of roughed up by a bunch of big guys. And you can see him watching this, and he's thinking about it, but you don't know what's going on in his head. He's mysterious. He's just standing there against the sky watching this happen, and he lets it happen. He doesn't stop them. He doesn't immediately jump in and prove himself to be this knight in shining armor, which is what a John Wayne character would have done, what any number of the other kind of predictably honorable and heroic heroes would have done before that. He was somebody who was very ambiguous, and especially in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, you can see that he's just as much motivated by self-interest as the other two characters, Tuco and Angel Eyes. He's there for the money, and he happens to be a little bit better than those two, but he's there for the money too. What do you think this change in the character of the hero says about kind of our shifting ideals of manhood in the West?
Well, I think it's more realistic, you know, quite frankly. Those guys would have been survivalists first. I mean, they would have been taking care of themselves first and not getting mixed up in anything that they didn't need to get mixed up in, right? And so, I think in that regard, those movies anyway are more realistic. They certainly have their problems with respect to how things are set up physically, I guess you could say. I mean, just some things don't make sense, and you have to kind of overlook in order to.
It's one of the, like, you know, like walking down an empty street and not getting shot, but shooting everybody on the rooftop.
Yeah, I mean, shooting a rope at, you know, 150 yards. I mean, but when the guy's swinging, that's a whole different matter. You know, I mean, you have to hit a moving target that's a quarter of an inch in diameter, you know, at 100 yards.
Without a scope.
Yeah, without a scope, yeah.
Yeah, but those are details. Of course, the hero can do it. It's because he's the hero.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more along the lines of asking, okay, what is this saying about how we view heroes? And I think that as we were getting into the 60s, we were kind of starting to question authority more. And, you know, it was the 60s. That's what everybody did.
There have been some of that.
Of course, on the other hand, these movies have pretty much been embraced by every manly man in America ever since.
Oh yeah, I mean
Now, an extreme example of kind of this tendency to deconstruct the Western hero is Unforgiven, which came out in the 90s, I believe, and that was directed by Clint Eastwood. And in that movie, he really takes the character of the gunman and just completely shows the dark and the gritty side of being a hired killer, and I didn't really like the movie the first time I watched it. I might like it more now, I don't know, but it's just so miserable. And, you know, I don't know. But that was kind of an extreme example of that.
I've not seen that movie.
It's a pretty good movie. Now, I think that I wanted to use that as a segue to our next discussion, because we're moving on a little bit from movies. And we're kind of moving into a little bit more political talk.
Yeah. Okay.
So, if the image that the American cowboy presents is something that's kind of uniquely American. I mean, it's true that a lot of cowboy movies were based on Japanese samurai films.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a very unique American phenomenon. I think mostly because and I can't see them happening in Britain, for instance. You wouldn't see a British guy being like that, because this is a loner hero. He's very much the individualist with a gun, who's out on his own making his way in the world, motivated by self-interest. He's kind of a libertarian hero. He's kind of an essentially American hero because of the way he operates, because of the way he relates to the world. And it's this elevation of the individual instead of the community. It's the individual's job to come into town and create justice, you know, by any means possible. Taking that as a more classical example of the Western man, I want to talk about where we are now. What is the Western hero now? What does the Western man look like? I think it's changed, because we've become much more politically correct. We focus much more, rightly or wrongly, on community instead of the individual, instead of what you can achieve on your own.
That's true.
Yeah.
I think there's a. I think that the population centers with the big media controls the perception of what you know, say the American man or the American male is, and they do that through TV and movies and music. However, there are lots of men. Just talk about men for a moment. There are lots of men out there in our world, the rural world, as I mean, that are still very individualistic. You know, they still hunt, they still fish, they still trap. I had a friend that, a young man that actually did blacksmithing, and you know, when he went to Virginia Tech, there were people were just like, you know, who are you? You know, what planet did you just walk off of? And you know, we have friends that make maple syrup. We have friends that, you know, tan hides. And you know, popular culture, quote unquote culture, carries no value with that kind of thing. You know, I mean, that they would look on that in one of many different ways. Well, you know, you're being abusive to animals, or you're brandishing guns, you know, or you are even maybe just going so far as, you know, damaging the environment by clearing land or whatever it might be. So there's this huge disconnect between, you know, what the perception is, but I really strongly believe there's still this underlying foundation of these men out there that can do all these different things. There's not as many as there used to be. And if under the right circumstances, they will rise up. And what I mean by rise up is that you know, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And I think these are the tough guys. I mean, those are the guys that are going to survive. They're going to take care of their families. They're going to take care of their neighbors, and quite frankly, even their communities. When everybody else is trying to figure out how to turn on a generator.
Possibly, I'm less optimistic, at least on a larger scale, because I do think there are those people out there, especially in flyover country.
Where we live.
It's more of a conservative ideal, the elevation of the individual, while liberals tend to be much more, I don't know, communist. And so you have those contrasts, but I tend to think that society as a whole can't rely on the dwindling population of individuals, you know.
I know what you mean, but...
And the society as a whole is already not relying on them. Already a lot of our problems come from the fact that we expect the greater society as a whole to support us instead of acting as
and
themselves.
I think that that's true for about any society on some level. I mean, it's the rare person that can truly be self-sufficient, you know, that in total. I mean, even 100 years ago, you know, you would get your flour, right, ground at the mill or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you still have to depend on one another. But even me, and I'm not as self-reliant as a lot of guys. But I know how a lot of things work and how things fix things and, you know, try to put things together and all. But I enjoy that kind of stuff. It's just that my job is not doing that. My job is something different. So, you know, I just think about these guys that live in suburbia that go to ball games and they take their kids to swim meets and they go golfing. I just don't understand, you know. And then when there's a plumbing problem, they call a plumber. You know, I mean, I don't understand that.
I mean, personally, I don't believe in the elevation of the individual or the elevation of the society. I am much more of a community person. I'm a communitarian, which is kind of which means like small communities, you know, small churches and private individuals, and instead of huge federal groups, things like that. I think that, and it's, I think that's the best Christian way to approach it, is to say, okay, you know, you need to get a congregation together of people who can help each other. It's a group of individuals, but it's not just individual or not just a nation. It's a group of smaller people who can talk one-on-one and things like that.
And celebrities have taken the place of, right? I mean, is it people know more now about, you know, the Kardashians or whoever than they do about their own neighbors?
It's true that because of the way the internet, and I'm not blaming the internet entirely, but just kind of the way we relate in a technology age, we have this false illusion of intimacy with people on the internet. And I'm not being reactionary or conservative about that, because I've got most of my friends are on the internet. Most of my friends all through high school were on the internet. So I know that you can make real relationships on the internet. But at the same time, there really is something to be said for meeting somebody and talking to somebody one-on-one. It's not the same as interacting on the internet. It's just not the same. And you have to learn a different set of rules, a different set of guidelines to deal with people, to deal with their nuances and to...
Well, that's a truth. I mean, you know,
that's why there aren't many successful con men anymore, you know.
Well, they're called hackers.
Yeah, you've only got hackers anymore.
And the internet in that regard has kind of changed the game a lot. And it's probably not for the better in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between having a friend and having a Facebook friend.
Yeah, there's lots of good things that can come from it, reconnecting and staying in touch and all that. But, you know, I mean, do you really need to know what so-and-so had for breakfast down in, you know, Tennessee today? I don't know. I mean, it just seems a little ridiculous. But it's become more, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep rather than waters.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Too bad. What's that got to do with Westerns?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out where we got from there. I think we were talking about men. We were talking about manliness and individualism.
Ooh.
I think that Westerns are a libertarian fantasy. It's totally libertarian escapism, where you have the individual out alone solving problems with the gun.
Yeah.
Which I admit is kind of cool.
And he usually has a happy ending.
He usually has a happy ending. And he ends the movie by, you know, solving all of society's problems and going back...
Riding off in the sunset.
Yep, with his marijuana, presumably.
No.
It's not quite a libertarian fantasy then.
Libertarians are dangerous people.
The more I think about it, I think extreme libertarians are just as bad as extreme liberals. Maybe not quite as bad, but it's like when you have a society that has problems,
mm-hmm.
then you end up with people polarizing instead of a kind of a moderate example of something. You end up with either people who don't work at all or people who work too hard, or you end up with people who believe in community above all things, or who believe in the individual above all things, but who can't see a balance, who don't see personal responsibility, or who don't see your responsibility
to
help others.
I think the libertarians, as a rule, lack individual responsibility. I mean, they would say, you know, they want smaller government, and that's great. You know, I'm kind of right there with them. But they may take it to an extreme where they would say, you know, basically no government in many cases. And I, you know, while that may appeal to me in some regards, I also recognize that we're a nation, or we used to be, of laws, and that those laws are very important. I mean, you look at third world countries, it's just, it is a wild west, right? I mean, there's no law, you know, there's bribes and there's corruption and all those things, and I don't want that. And so I almost feel like that's the natural end of libertarianism, because if there's no moral bridle on this horse, then it's just going to run rampant. It's going to run free.
I mean, the problem with libertarians is they kind of elevate selfishness to a virtue.
Yeah.
They say, okay, self-interest, if I'm acting completely from self-interest, I could never go wrong. Obviously, if I act from self-interest, it will be the best thing, not only for me, but for you too, which doesn't make sense.
I think it's very dangerous to start saying stuff like, I'm not hurting anyone else. Well, you know, I'm doing this particular act. I'm a consenting adult, fill in the blank, and I'm not hurting anyone else by doing that. But you are hurting the fabric of, you know, the moral fabric of our society. And what's left of it? What's left of the moral fabric of our society?
The tattered moral fabric of our society.
And those individual rips in that fabric add up. I mean, you know, you think it's no big deal, but it is a big deal. Because because what you are comes out when you are around people. I mean, if I'm a horrid, miserable, lecherous person in my private life,
Joe Biden,
then that's going to come out in my public life. I mean, it just is, in a number of ways. And those things break down that moral fabric. And I see libertarians kind of in that vein. Maybe it's a poor example, and maybe not even should say it, but, you know, one of the guys that I like listening to the most on the internet is a guy that his blog is The Vodka Pundit, right? And I like what he has to say a lot. He's very libertarian. But the name, you know, of his... It's a problem. I mean, it's an issue.
I mean, he's got kids.
Yeah, he's got kids, and he's got followers, and he's got influence on people. And he's going to be the first to say, well, look, you know, this is my decision, my choice. Granted, okay. And I certainly don't have to listen to him, but I like a lot what he has to say. But it just, those things have a way of rippling out into society.
Yeah, libertarians trust the individual too much, and liberals trust the government too much.
Yeah, I am not.
I mean,
I want local government. I don't want big government.
And that's what I mean. I mean, that's why the term communitarian refers to somebody who kind of wants a small community to deal with people.
Yes.
To, you know, like a church. I think that's the best model for society. Because that way you can interact with people on an individual level. You're not just doing blanket things, you know, and so you're able to, and there is a level of self-responsibility in a society that small. So you have to have that that personal responsibility.
I don't know how the United States government the federal government will ever become smaller. I mean, it's a huge problem.
Maybe if you got somebody like Scott Walker in there who can turn around. What is it, Wisconsin in a few years?
Yes, but...
As the New York Times calls him, Mr. Scott. You know, the New York Times defended Brian Williams. I think it's an interesting mental exercise to read through the article by Frank Bruni in which he defends Brian Williams and replace every occurrence of the word Williams with the word Durante. And if you don't know who Walter Durante is, I suggest you look him up on Wikipedia, because if there's any other reason, that's what makes the New York Times defending Brian Williams a joke.
Well,
I
don't know. I don't know.
They have the moral high ground.
I don't know what kind of influence the New York Times has anymore. Everyone knows how partisan they are. And
supposedly, I mean, a lot of the people that I follow who think they're kind of conservative but they're really kind of liberal, and are, I mean, you know, they're kind of Christian guys, but they're kind of, oh well, we need to, you know, understand the oppressed and blah blah blah. They think the New York Times is kind of like the network news because it's the establishment.
Now they think that's what they think of the New York Times?
I think so. Now people my age don't read it.
I mean, I don't know if anyone in my entire life that ever got a subscription that I know of. Of course, I mean, but they're very influential. I don't think they're as influential as they used to be, probably. But and they're so ridiculously partisan that, you know, I mean, I just don't understand. I guess it's like the mainstream media, is that people feel like they have to watch and trust the nightly news just because their dad watched and trusted the nightly news.
Yeah, maybe Brian Williams has sounded the death knell for that. I hope so.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he certainly got it caught with his hand in the cookie jar. But there have been others with that happen, and they turned around and said, "Wait, what are you doing in the kitchen?"
Well, speaking of the moral fabric of our society, or lack thereof, I wanted to talk about ISIS and kind of how they perceive that moral fabric, because ISIS are kind of a phenomenon outside of our tradition, outside of our traditions here, outside of our thought, and particularly our modern secular world. We don't really understand we don't understand them, we don't understand how they think or why they act the way they do. And I wanted to talk about that. Recently, of course, they were in the news because of an execution that they performed in Egypt of 21 Coptic Christians. They were also, jihad was in the news because of the attacks on Charlie Hebdo in France. I think there was just today an attack by a Muslim man of at least two, maybe three people, after he asked them whether they were Muslims and they said no, in some sort of religious discussion. Anyway, so ISIS is all over the news, but no one seems to really understand why ISIS exists, or what ISIS wants. I mean, presumably, according to the White House, ISIS wants jobs. They actually came out and in some sort of press conference and said something along the lines of, well, you know, we're killing a lot of them right now, and we're going to kill more of them, but we need to fix the root problems here, and, you know, so we're, like, you know, the lack of jobs and a lack of income, and we're, you know, we want to fix those sort of things, so... You know,
you should drop jobs on them.
They should, you know. I hear John Stewart.
Or Shovels. We could drop
Shovels.
He's
retiring. Maybe they could have his job.
Yeah, that's right.
Or Brian Williams. I mean, they might as well.
They do. They know how to produce, that's for sure.
So here's my question. Obviously, ISIS doesn't need jobs. Maybe it would help if they could hold down a job, but what do they need? What is the correct response to ISIS? And why?
From a Christian standpoint or from an American standpoint?
Well, let's start from a political standpoint.
I don't think you can have too big of a hammer for these guys. I mean, they only understand, here's the deal. I mean, in my opinion, is that this ideology is so counter to Western thought that this confrontation was inevitable. Is inevitable. And so they only understand they only understand overwhelming force and ruthlessness. Just ruthlessness. And until we are as ruthless as they are, within reason, and when I say within reason, I mean giving the military broad power to execute their missions. If a guy runs into a mosque and it's being held up and he's not coming out, they level the mosque, you know, that kind of thing. We, at this point, at least my understanding is that those are the kind of things we don't do. And as harsh as it is to say, you know, that there's no quarter for anyone that's harboring the enemy. War is, you know, I mean, again, from a political standpoint, I think you have to meet the enemy head on and remove the threat. Maybe you start with the guys in Guantanamo. I mean, I don't know. It's very antithetical, I think, to what we as Americans are used to doing and want to do. But I think that's what it'll eventually have to be in order to neutralize the threat.
So what do you think is really motivating ISIS? Because I think that we're attempting to transpose our own ideas and our own desires onto them and say, okay, well, if I was in their position and I didn't have a job, I'd want a job, and maybe I'd fight somebody if I didn't have a job.
Well,
these guys aren't fighting because they want a job. They're fighting but from a particularly religious motivation. The Obama administration is reasonably enough saying, okay, these guys aren't true Islamists. They're saying that because they don't want to alienate their own Islamic allies, you know, in Saudi Arabia or wherever. And I can understand that, but you have to deal with the fact that these guys are religious, that they do have religious motives, and that the only way to approach them is to understand that, to understand where they're coming from and how to defeat it. You can't just pretend that these guys are somehow unreligious. That's just...
Yeah, I mean, it's religion in its purest form. Is that because they are physically acting to receive their reward, right? That's what they believe, that their actions are pure and holy, I guess you'd say, and right. And that's a very powerful thing to overcome. Most Americans don't have that kind of passion anymore about anything, hardly. And so that has to be broken. And I think that the United States has missed a golden opportunity in some ways. I got to be careful here, but in some ways, in, you know, here you have Jordan up in arms over it, and you have Egypt up in arms over it, is to, you know, quickly build a coalition around these guys. And I mean, I think it's troops on the ground. I just think it's boots on the ground, and I think it's, you know, maybe it's, I got to be careful because I don't know much about the president of Egypt, this new guy, and I don't know much about the king in Jordan. But they seem to be relatively level-headed leaders, you know. I mean, I could talk about the background of that in many ways, but you know, maybe it's just saying, okay, guys, you know, which part of this country do you want after we carve it up, you know, and just, I don't know, it's very difficult, but I think it's going to take some big ideas and a lot of resolve and a lot of dedication.
I do think at its base it is an ideological and religious conflict. And the front that we have presented is one of doubt and uncertainty.
Oh yeah.
And that's spearheaded by the Obama administration, who don't really know what they're standing for. And, you know, at the National Prayer Breakfast he talked about the importance of doubt. And in the context of the speech that made sense, because he was saying, okay, you know, if you have extreme religious views, you know, you need to think, okay, maybe I could be wrong. Maybe this is not the way to go. And he thinks that's the way to deal with ISIS, is to say, guys, has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong? And that would be one thing if you were talking to Westerners.
Yes.
But I really don't think that's the way to deal with ISIS.
No.
We have friends who have, some of our most strongly conservative friends have had the best success in talking to Muslims because they have common ground. They understand how to talk to conservative Muslims, because conservative Muslims don't understand liberals. They're like, okay, no, we don't doubt it, because that, you just don't do that.
Right.
Christians and pagans had much more in common with each other than either has with a post-Christian. The gap between those who worship different gods is not so wide as that between those who worship and those who don't. The pagan and Christian ages alike are ages of the externalized, enacted idea.
Now, but they can respect you if you walk up to them and say, you know, the Quran says this about Isa, who is Jesus. I want to talk to you about that. I want to talk to you about what I believe without questioning. You need to present something else. You don't need to say, has it ever occurred to you that, you know, maybe Allah doesn't like you blowing yourself up on this bridge?
Yeah, I mean, that gets nowhere.
And explain to me about your feelings. Talk to me about your feelings.
Yeah.
And these guys, I can almost sympathize with them, despise that. They despise our talk about being eternally introspective and, oh, you know, I'm not sure about anything, you know.
Yeah, they...
I think I am. Rene Descartes, you know, they don't understand that. We're living in a post-enlightenment world that they are not.
Yep.
And the way to respond to that is to turn around and figure out what our ideology is, what we stand for, and to say we stand for freedom of speech. And not to say we stand for freedom of speech, but there was a recent shooting in Copenhagen, and there's a very harrowing recording of the moments before the gunshots fired out, and it was a freedom of speech gathering, believe it or not. And there was a lady who was speaking, and she was saying, why do we always say freedom of speech, but why do we always need to qualify that? Why can't we just say we believe in freedom of speech? Why do we have to always kind of step away from just a positive statement and kind of make a quibble with this statement? And it's about at that point in the video, in the audio, in which the gunshots ring out and you can hear people running. It's just incredible incredible.
I mean, you know, the United States was founded on, I mean, we're no longer a melting pot, to me. I mean, it's no longer that American principles are not taught and not appreciated as how unusual and precious they are in the world.
Well, we don't believe they are.
Because we don't believe they are. And that's too bad. I mean, well, too bad. It's tragic. Well, it is.
And yeah, I mean, and it's understandable that people object to imperialism and to over-certainty and all of those things. However, the solution isn't to go to the opposite extreme and to say, okay, we're just not going to be certain about anything.
I mean, one of the clearest, maybe clearest examples of that is, my understanding is when we fought in Kuwait in the 90s and probably in Iran and, I mean, in Iraq and Afghanistan, my understanding was is that some of the troops weren't allowed Bibles. You know if that's true?
I'm not aware of that.
I think that might be true, is that they weren't allowed, you know, to have, now they might have, I don't know, but there was, if I'm not mistaken, there was some rule about that. And if that's true...
Because they were, like, afraid they would proselytize or something?
Yes, that they were, yeah. You know, a crusading army coming in to, you know, to save the day or whatever. And if that's true, that's just absolutely tragic, because that just says, well, we believe in, you know, freedom of thought and freedom of expression, unless
you talk about it.
Unless there's these circumstances, and that's just not right. I don't agree with that at all. I mean, these individual troops should have had the right to read and to have any kind of literature that they wanted, you know, while they were there.
I mean, moderns are so schizophrenic about proselytizing. I mean, one minute they're saying that it would be the worst thing for you to take advantage of somebody and convert them to your faith, and remove them from their cultural context, and you're just doing that so that you can oppress them, and you want to force your religion on them. And next minute they're saying, well, you know, your God can't be everywhere, and people are born into their own religions. If you think your own religion is right, you know, then people overseas, what about them? What about these people who aren't part of your religion? And yet they get mad at you when you try and convert people to your religion. You can't win.
Yeah. I think the other thing that we kind of messed up in the war there is that if George Bush, in my opinion, had been smart, he would have said, look, he would have gotten a map out and shown Iraq and Afghanistan, in particular, Iraq in the geographical importance of Iraq, and then turned around the camera and said, we're going to be there for 50 years. We're going to be there for 50 years. This is a 50-year campaign. This is a generational change. It's not going to happen in 3 years. It's not going to happen in 4 years. We're going to be there for 50 years minimum. And if my predecessor, the next president, chooses not to do that, then it's on him. You know, then everything that falls apart from that belongs to him. But if you want to win this, this ideological war, that's what it's going to take.
And that thought is courtesy of Vodka Pundit.
Oh, is that right?
It is, yeah.
Well, that's mine too. I didn't know that.
It's
another milk bag.
And that kind of brings me to the idea of a holy war. We need to move on, but do you think that it's always wrong? And I know I said last week I think it's always wrong to kill in the name of religion, but I've been thinking about it. Do you think it's always wrong to say that your army, you know, that God is on your side, that you're fighting for Christianity? I mean...
But it's always wrong to say that?
Yeah, I mean, because people say to kill in the name of religion is always bad.
Ooh. Probably not. I mean... Probably not. I do recognize that there's a danger with that, and I may have a different opinion tomorrow on this one. But as of right now, I would say that there are circumstances where, you know, it's just so clear that you're facing evil, and evil forces that it you know, displeases God, that it goes against everything that he is. And
I mean, there has been a long tradition in Christianity of just wars, of the idea of a just war, in which you will justify your war on certain principles. Self-defense. I think St. Augustine wrote some on this, I'm not sure. But we don't talk much about that anymore. I tend to think that it is wrong to wage a war to convert people, because that is not the way to do it.
Well, I'll say this.
But I think that to wage a war on a principle, saying, okay, the enemy is doing this, this is why we are going to stop them. The enemy is killing innocent people and shutting down freedom of speech and all these things, then I think that you're going to have to wage an ideological war back and say, okay, we stand for freedom of speech and that is what we are fighting for.
I will say this. I don't know if the United States, I'm quite confident, but the United States could not say God is on our side. Right? Are there instances, and have there been instances in the past where certain armies or certain actions might have had God's blessing? Yeah, I think so. But I'm not so sure that America is in a position to make that claim. I'm confident we're not.
I think, but the deal is that if you're going to make the claim that God is on your side, that means you have to be perfect.
Right.
I don't think that's true. I think that you can say, okay, in general, we are fighting for a principle which we believe that God supports, the idea of freedom or the idea of grace or forgiveness or, you know, peace, not killing innocent people. Okay, and I mean, I think that in many ways, God was on the side of the Allies during World War II because the Nazis were just overwhelmingly evil. However, as I've been reading, you know, I think that the Allied attack on Dresden was not a good thing. It was there were atrocities committed by the Allies too.
Oh yeah.
Still, I think there is a place to talk about, you know, justification for one side or the other. I mean, you can't just morally equivocate everything by
saying that, you know, we're bad too, and look what happened in the Crusade 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, not that of course anybody would say that.
Right. Yeah, you can, you know, I think you have to take I go back to my statement that in instances of clear acts of evil, and I'll say this, is that, you know, there's some horrific things going on in the Middle East. And there have been recent horrific things that went on in Africa, right?
Yeah.
Also in the name of Islam. And those are, you know, those are very, very disturbing. I think the United States, you know, sometimes I think we're interested in the Middle East because of the oil. We're not really interested in Africa because it's just Africans killing Africans, and who cares, you know? And that's tragic that we should think that way. But that's the way we think, and that's why one of many reasons I think the United States would not be able to lay claim to a just war from God's perspective. I think we can do good. We can be a force for good, but it's just tainted almost anymore. I mean, our efforts are just tainted with cultural debauchery and, you know, quite frankly, keep coming back to the abortion thought. So, how can I And, you know,
I mean, it is indeed daunting to read some of the things that happened during Jim Crow. They were talking about somebody who was burned alive during Jim Crow as well, and it was just horrifying. But I don't think you have to. I think there's a place where you can say that is bad, and I completely condemn that just as much as I condemn ISIS. And at some point, you have to have some sort of high horse you can get on just to condemn those things. You can't just say, okay, all those things are bad, so we don't have any right to do what? To condemn? We have to have some basis to condemn because we are a nation, and a nation is built to dispense justice.
Based on their ideals.
Yeah, at some point, you're going to have some basis for justice, and you can't continually be hemming and hawing about things in the past, and you've got to say, yes, that is bad, and if it were happening right now, I would stop it.
And this is worth fighting
for. And this is worth fighting for. Yeah. And this is worth fighting against.
Yes. Right. Yeah. That's exactly right. But I don't know what it... I don't know... Again, it takes resolve. These guys are very patient. They know. They can wait us out. And they've been proven right in that.
It's not something just to be discounted. The whole glamour, excuse me, of ISIS. The idea of a man going out and seeking for glory, and being able to conquer things. I think this is a desire that especially young men that in the West have kind of it lays dormant. But I think that men look at that and think, okay, that's kind of what I'm made to do. I'm made to go out and fight and conquer, even in a form as twisted as ISIS. And they are very good at public relations. They've got recruiting videos that show these young guys in black with guns, and you know, we know a young fellow who's always talking about glory and conquering things, and
we do.
And it's a very appealing to young men.
And you know, and from their perspective is that they've had missiles dropped on them, and they've had bombs dropped on them, and they've had, you know, airplanes flying overhead, and you know, they want to fight back against that.
Well,
right?
But if we were
in their position, if we were here in the United States and we were being bombed by another country, we would be absolutely livid, right? And
yeah,
especially if we weren't able to strike back.
But you had Islamic terrorism even way back before.
Oh yeah, I know that. I'm just saying that a part of me can kind of understand, and that's why I think it's so important to have boots on the ground to have men in combat. To take the fight to them on the ground. I think it's very important, not just to do this from, you know, Colorado underneath some mountain, flying a drone over Baghdad and dropping laser-guided missiles. Just That will not work against these guys.
Well, these guys, I don't think they're looking so much at our military as just because, I mean, they're always fighting each other, but they really hate the West because of our society. They look at us and they see us as decadent and just morally bankrupt.
Yep.
And they're mostly right, but they look at that and imagine the most conservative Christian person you can imagine, and you know, or conservative cult member or something, and then multiply that by 10. These guys are Pharisees of the highest level.
Oh yeah,
these guys are living in the Middle Ages, at least the Islamic Middle Ages. The Christian Middle Ages, you know, they were at least building cathedrals. These guys are just shooting people. They're thugs.
The Dark Ages weren't so unfruitful in progress as we sometimes think.
And the glory of it, the glamour of it, it's like gangs in cities. These young men wanting to go out and
I mean, it's a power thing, and they...
It's all about power.
I don't understand... I don't know. I don't understand. I mean, I think there's a huge cultural divide there, too, and that's why... Huge cultural divide. And I think that's why it would take a generation to change it. And even then, it may not take. But if you had young men and women who had been raised in schools and had access to health care and had opportunities and jobs, you know, for a generation, then yeah, you know, I think things would start maybe to change. But on the other hand, remember those photographs from Afghanistan from the 50s or whatever?
Yeah.
You know,
but
I mean,
it's not that problem. That's the thing. It is not a physical problem. We think that we can solve this with physical means. That's what we've been talking about. This is an ideological problem. You have to figure out a way to infiltrate this radical.
Where the proselytizing comes in. So
exactly.
Then, you know, so
drop a bunch of missionaries in there.
That's right. I mean, you know,
and there's a fellow named Canon Andrew White over there who is an Anglican vicar. He's the vicar of the last Anglican church in Baghdad, St. George's. He's something else, and he says that there's nothing that he hates more than woolly liberals.
We're not woolly liberals. We don't like that at all. When we say something, we believe it. When we talk about the Word of God, we believe in practicing the Word of God.
I recommend you look him up. But he says, these guys, you've got to talk real talk with them.
Yeah, they would understand cowboys.
Yeah, they would.
But they don't understand Easterners.
Yeah, they would understand Westerns.
Yes.
And their particular form of valor is a twisted and bent version of the Western. It's taking individualism to its terrible end and saying, okay, we're going to go out for glory. And, you know, it's self-interest unbridled.
Yeah. Yeah, it's legalism run amok. It's really the end game for legalism. And
it's a world without grace.
And religion. So, yeah, it's a world without grace. That's what it looks like.
Well, I guess we better go ahead and wrap it up. And
we
don't have any idea what we're talking about next week, do we?
No, we don't. We'll have to work on that.
Yeah, I mean, we were going to do our Tale of Two Cities Dreamcast. But we might have to do a special episode with that because I'm not sure anybody else would be interested.
I think we should...
We could talk about Charles Dickens.
Well, we could talk about the perspective... Charles Dickens, yeah, or we could talk about the prospective election, or the election coming up in 2016. Ooh.
Which is something I don't know much about, but you will enjoy talking about.
Yeah. And or some of our favorite bloggers or programs on the internet that we watch or keep up.
Okay, well, until further notice, we'll be talking about Charles Dickens next week, and we'll talk about various adaptations of his work and kind of some of the ideas that motivated that, and maybe we'll use those ideas as a jumping off point for other topics.
Absolutely.
Including the presidential election, though I'm not sure how in the world we will connect those.
We'll work on that.
Okay. Well, until next week. Oh, wait a minute. I've got to tell you where you can find us. We're all over the web. We're on Twitter. We've got a Twitter page, @PilgrimsPodcast. We're also on Twitter as Longishing Rope Boy. You can follow us there. We're on Facebook. We have a blog. If you have any comments on this episode, you can comment at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com, and we'll read your comments on the air. So I guess that's it for this week.
All right. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Yep.
Please come back.
Yep. Do
and like us on
iTunes. Yeah. Make sure you leave us a review on iTunes. And
hit like for the review.
5 stars, because obviously we are a 5-star program.
We try.
We do.
We're here for you. You be here for us.
Okay. Until next week, decide what you believe and act on it.
Adios.
Don't take care, take risks. As you leave church, they say, oh, take care. You can't take care in Baghdad. I say take risks. Take risks for the gospel of Jesus Christ. His whole ministry was about taking risks. Dangerous work that we're involved in. But it's God's work. So it's great.